Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first episode of A True Crime Boulevard. I'm your host, Bree. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoy this episode, so we're going to hop right into it. So in this episode, we're going to be talking about the DC Sniper. I grew up in the DMV area. I kind of don't remember anything about this case. So that's kind of why I wanted to do it, because I've heard so many people talk about it. They talk about how like crazy it was and like just how scary it was. So I wanted to like do some research into it, and I'm gonna tell you guys about it. So now, if you weren't living in the area or you don't remember the case like me, this is gonna be a crazy story. There's a lot going on. So trigger warning, that's gun violence, child abuse, domestic abuse. So if any of those topics are hard for you, that's cool. Protect your mental health, and I pray you can come back and join us in a future episode. So this killing spree happened over a 3-week period, and it was in the nation's capital and surrounding states, hint DMV. So in October of 2002, October 2nd, a shot was fired through a Michael's window, and nobody was hit. It's a craft store. It was in Aspen Hill, Maryland. No one was hit. On the same day the first killing happened, 55-year-old James D. Martin, a program analyst, was shot and killed in the parking lot of a Shoppers Food Warehouse. It was a grocery store. But no one linked the two shootings on the first day. So the next day, October 3rd, the police were called, and they saw James L. Buchanan, a 39-year-old landscaper, was fatally shot while he was mowing the lawn at a commercial establishment. And then again on the same day, there was another call for 54-year-old Prima Kumar Walkyar. He was a part-time cab driver. He was killed getting gas in Aspen Hills. Sarah Ramos, 34, of Silver Springs, she was killed in another shopping center. Witnesses there said they saw a white van or like truck pull off, so a bullet went out for a white box truck or a car, whatever. And then on the same day, Lori Ann Lewis Rivera, 25, of Silver Springs, was shot dead at a gas station in Kensington. And then Pascal Charlotte, 72, was shot in the chest in Washington, D.C. He was the only person to get shot in Washington, D.C. He was the only one that got shot at night, and he died about an hour after he was shot. So initially, nobody connected these, but by the end of October 3rd, they had been connected, and police had again put out the bolo for the white box truck. At some point, they ended up putting out a bolo for a sedan, a Chevy sedan, because that was another thing people had seen. Another eyewitness came out and was like, no, it was this kind of car and not the white box truck. So they had a lot of different reports going around. So that was kind of an issue in the beginning, but once they figured it out, they realized what was going on. Now, crazy thing that happened is the men that did the shooting were pulled over on October 3rd, and they were let go. There was like a traffic stop that it was put in the system or whatever, but they were let go. Nobody did anything. So on October 4th, the next day, in a Michael's parking lot in Fredericksburg, Virginia, Caroline Sewell, 43, was shot as she was putting bags inside of her minivan. She survived it, and she went home on October 7th. 3 days later, Eron Brown, 13, was shot and critically wounded outside of his middle school in Bowie, Maryland. He survived. He later testified in the trials. In 2009, it was revealed on like through the news and stuff that there was a tarot card that was left at one of the crime scenes that said, "Call me God." Now, the image that was on the tarot card is typically a sign for like death. It's like the death card. The snipers had said, "Don't release to the public." The cops tried to keep it under wraps, but it eventually got leaked. And then on October 9th, Dean Harold Myers, 53, of Gaithersburg, Maryland, he was killed pumping gas in Manassas, Virginia. And a white minivan was seen in the area, but that was later cleared by police. On October 11th, Kenneth Bridges, 53, a Philadelphia businessman, was killed at an Exxon station right off I-95 near Fredericksburg, Virginia. Police tried to put out like really big roadblocks, still looking for this white van. It was similar to a Chevy Astro, but that wasn't the car that ended up needing to look for, but they did figure that out later. October 14th, 3 days later, Linda Franklin, 47, of Arlington, Virginia, was killed by a single gunshot in a Home Depot parking lot in Falls Church, Virginia. She was an FBI agent, so this kind of took things up a notch for the police and the FBI, who were already looking for this because it had crossed state lines. It was in DC, it was in Maryland, it was in Virginia at this point. FBI was in on this. They were trying to figure this out too. So with a lot of these shootings taking places at gas stations, many gas stations started putting up tarps and things. People were picking up their kids from school, dropping them off. They didn't want people to walk. They were telling kids to walk in zigzags because, you know, bullets go in straight lines, don't turn corners. So if you zigzag, you're less likely to get hit. But you know, you're teaching kids this so that they don't get hit while they're outside. You know, people aren't just standing out talking. People are sitting in their cars when they're putting gas in their car instead of standing next to the pump because they're terrified. I was talking to my sister about this, and she was talking about having to walk our dog and her being like terrified. I was talking to my mom was talking about like having to go to work, and like it was a crazy time. And so yeah, that was just, you know, a wild time in the DMV area because there's the shooting taking place that was random. You never knew who was going to get hit next. You never knew where people were. So October 19th, 2002, Jeffrey Hopper, 37, he was shot in a parking lot on a Ponderosa Steakhouse near I-95 in Ashland, Virginia. He was 83 miles south of Washington, D.C. Doctors removed the bullets, and that's how they connected him. They connected the ballistics from his shootings to the other ones. He did survive that shooting. On October 22nd, bus driver Conrad Johnson, 35, of Oxon Hill, Maryland, he was shot while he was standing inside his commuter bus in Aspen Hill. He later died in Bethesda, Maryland. He is the last victim of this killing spree. So, like I said, the cops have been investigating this from day one. They had put up barriers, but they could never find them. At one point, the shooters had went to Henrico, Virginia, and they called the tip line, kind of like bragging to the police. And while they did that, they mentioned a shooting that happened in Montgomery, Alabama, of Claudine Parker, a 52-year-old liquor store clerk in Montgomery, who was shot in the chest and killed during a robbery. Now, her coworker was critically wounded, but she survived. And there was evidence at the scene that tied the killings to the killings of Claudine Parker and the people from the DC shootings or DMV shootings to Lee Boyd Malvo as a suspect, because there was a fingerprint on the shell casing and a fingerprint from the liquor store that were the same. And they ran it through CODIS and the systems and whatever it's called, and they found him. So from looking at Malvo's past and people that he was acquainted to, that's how they connected him to John Allen Muhammad. There was a point where Malvo had been arrested and John was like, oh yeah, that's my son. So that's kind of how they were linked together. They also went through the tip line, and there was a call from one of John's friends, Robert Holmes, who had been seeing the stuff on the news, and he had talked to one of his friends and was like, yo, I really think that's John and Lee. And his friend was like, yo, call the cops, like, call them, tell them. And he did, and it just kind of got lost in the shuffle of everything that was going on. But eventually they did call him back and they talked to him, and he described the car, he described the gun, everything that he remembered that Lee Boyd Malvo and John Allen Muhammad had while he was still around them and when he was hanging out with them. The cops came to his house and he led them to a tree stump where Leeboy Malvo had shot into the tree with this rifle that he had stolen. And they compared the ballistics of that, and that confirmed, like, okay, yeah, that's the same gun, that's the same person, all that stuff. So once they were able to put that stuff together, they looked up John Allen Muhammad's ex-wife to let her know what was going on, to tell her that, hey, we're going to name him as a suspect. And they put her into protective custody because she was already very much afraid of him. They had a very treacherous and abusive relationship towards the end. So after that, the FBI and police start looking into the DMV records, Department of Motor Vehicle records, to see if any reports had been put out on John recently. And they saw that he'd been pulled over on October 8th. But the officer that pulled him over didn't feel the need to search the car, even though they had a bolo out for a car that looked similar to his, even though there were things about that car that made him a little concerned. He saw things in the back seat that made him kind of like, or whatever. He said the license and the license plates didn't match. Like, the license was from Washington State, the license plates were from New Jersey. He was like, that was weird. But he decided not to search the car. Had he had searched the car, he would have found the sniper's nest immediately. But he didn't. So he took down the driver's information, the license plate information, but he let them go. On October 24th, 2 days after the last shooting of Conrad Johnson, Leeboy Malvo and John Allen Muhammad were found sleeping in their car in a rest stop in Frederick County, Maryland. They were in a 1990 Chevy Caprice. It was like navy blue. Someone had seen them. Well, someone had seen the car, and they called the police. The police went, they surrounded the car, and sure enough, it was them. Whew. So that was a lot. Like I said, that was a lot. Now that we know what they did, let's go back and figure out how we ended up where we did. So, John Allen Muhammad and Lee Boyd Malvo, these two men should have never crossed paths, and the fact that they did is crazy. So, John Allen Muhammad, or as he was formerly known as John Allen Williams, was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana on December 31st, 1960. His father, Ernest, and mother, Eva Williams, they lived there for a few years, but his mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, so they moved to New Orleans. She died when he was 3 years old. After that, his father left, and he was mainly raised by his maternal grandfather and his aunt. There really isn't a lot of information about how his life was after his mom passed away. In the I Sniper documentary, some of his family does come up and they do talk, but it doesn't seem like anything crazy happened in his family to make him do this. Like, he just kind of snapped. But in 1978, he enlisted in the National Guard in Louisiana as a combat engineer, and then he later transferred to the regular army in 1985. He was trained as a mechanic, as a truck driver, and as a specialist metal worker. And then he was qualified with the Army Standard Rifle, the M16, earning the Expert Rifleman's Badge. Now, this is the Army's highest of 3 levels of basic rifle marksmanship for a soldier. Later on, we will see that this helps him out in this whole situation, and in training Leeboy Malvo. So, his military career went relatively good for a while, until 1991, when he went to Desert Storm. He had joined the Nation of Islam when he was 27, and he had started trying to like recruit other black soldiers to also join the Nation of Islam. And for the most part, it was really cool. Nobody really had an issue. Everything was cool. In 1991, it started to be noticed that people were afraid of him. Specifically, white people were scared of him because of how he talked, some of the things that he said. There was a point that like they were driving, and whoever was driving the car, I can't quite remember, made a statement, and they saw like these people walking like on the side, and they made a statement like, I'm not gonna stop for these sand niggers. And like at that moment, John was like, all right, yeah, nothing's gonna change. It doesn't matter how much I serve, nothing's gonna help. Like, it's always gonna be a bad place for a black man to live. No one's ever gonna look past my skin. Like, he really started to get into like that kind of terminology, but it turned really, really dark really fast. That same night, he left their like chow, like they were eating dinner or whatever. He left, he went and got some grenades, wrapped them up, put them under a tent, and then boom. And everybody was like, what? Nobody got injured, but it was like, what just happened? So after that, he was under investigation for trying to kill his platoon sergeant, and he was sent back. He ended up being court-martialed because of this, and a lot of information came from this, but nothing was solid, nothing held. There was really no true evidence, nothing that was 100% to be like, yeah, he did this, so they had to let him go. He went about his life in the army for the next few years, and in April of 1994, after 17 years of service, he was honorably discharged from the army. So during that time, he got married. While he was in the army, he got married to Mildred. While he was married to her, they had a great relationship. She said, again, in the Eye Sniper documentary, she's in there. There's not a lot about her. She really doesn't talk much about everything, but she did talk about it in this particular documentary. And she said they had a great relationship prior to him going, being deployed, and being in Desert Storm. But when he came back, she said he was a complete different person. Like, it was a complete 180. He was quiet. He was manipulative. He was controlling. He tried to make her seem dumb, incapable of like being able to do anything for herself, for her children. They had two children together. After he got back, they ended up moving to like a coastal city in California to like raise their family. And then they had their third child while there. Mildred always said that he was great with the kids. Like, she said, whenever he was with the kids, it was like he was the man that he used to be, and she loved that. But when the kids were not in the picture and he wasn't directly dealing with the kids, it was this completely different person. So that led to Mildred saying, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm out. And in 1999, Mildred told him, I want a divorce. He was a Rolling Stone. He had, you know, hoes in different area codes. And she was over it. She was done. She didn't want to deal with it no more. She told him, I don't want you here. So in the process of him like getting his stuff and leaving, he was just being really weird and creepy towards her. Like, he would come in at night, like, because he still had a key to her house, and he would like walk in her room while she was sleeping and listen to her breathe. And it was just like really weird. It made her really uncomfortable. No one has said exactly when this happened, so I'm a little confused, but I know sometime in 1999, Muhammad, John, whatever, took his kids and went to Antigua for a little bit. Now, Mildred was freaking out. Of course, she had put out, you know, called the police, let them know, like, hey, my kids are missing, but he had forged documents, and the kids went to Antigua. Now, in Antigua, that is when John would meet Lee Boy Malvo and his mother, and that is how they would connect. So there was that. At some point in 1999, they came back to the U.S., and as soon as they got here, the cop, like, they were recognized. I think their documents were, like, flagged or something, and, like, they were immediately recognized. The cops came, took the kids back to their mom. They went to court. The judge told him, like, bro, you can't see your kids, period. Like, there's no visitation, no custody, no nothing. So he was very upset. There was also a restraining order put out so that he could not come anywhere near her or the kids. When the police saw all this about John, about his kids, about his ex-wife, they went to her and was like, hey, we're going to announce that we think this is your husband and that we're looking for him. And that we're looking for his car and all this stuff. And they asked her if she wanted to go in protective custody. She was like, yes, because she was very fearful. And at some point during the actual like active shootings, there were points where she thinks that he was there, like around her house. There was people, like she said, there was a car sitting outside of her home. So she just knew that she needed to keep her head on a swivel at all times, and she did. So at that point, again, the police captured John and he went to prison. Now, Lee Boyd Malvo. Again, John and Lee Boyd Malvo met in Antigua in 1999. Lee Boyd Malvo was 17 at the time. He was a young boy. He was 15, I'm sorry. 15 at the time when they met. 14, 15, somewhere around that. When they met, young man. He had just got to Antigua with his mother. Him and his mother had moved around a lot. He was from Kingston, Jamaica. He lived there with his mom and his dad. They were never married, but they all lived together for a while. Eventually, his mom left his dad, and from there, they moved a lot. There was a point where Malvo was living at a living at his school, like boarding at his school, but he also was he had a really close relationship with his teacher, and his mom had already went to Antigua, and she called and was like, hey, yo, send my kid. And the teacher was like, do I have to? And she was like, yeah. So that's how he ended up in Antigua. Had he had stayed in Jamaica, I think he probably would have like thrived and been like this really like great kid. So when he got to Antigua, his mom had already met John Allen Muhammad, and John Allen Muhammad helped his mom be able to move to Florida. Malvo's mom moved to Florida. The plan was that once she got to Florida and got settled, Malvo would come behind her. That did not happen. He ended up staying in Antigua with Muhammad for a while. Muhammad got him to convert to Islam. And in 2001, they came to Miami. At some point, they moved to Washington, but they had been caught by Border Patrol. And his mom, Una Johnson, his mom and Malvo were caught. Malvo was released on bond. Now, I'm not 100% sure why Malvo was able to stay in the States. If I'm not mistaken, his mom was deported. He lived in a bunch of different homeless shelters with Muhammad. And then he was also in high school. But his high school principal was like, they never could really get him. Like he was in school technically, but like it was a lot of trouble getting him in school because it was like, he's not from America. Is he from America? Like, can he be here? Should he be here? There's a lot of questions about his status as like a citizen and if he should be in school. But while he was in high school, he never made friends. They ended up going to Tacoma, Washington, Malvo and Muhammad. And at some point, they stole a rifle from a gun store. Like, they went in, he asked to see a gun. The guy who was behind the counter, like, turned his back, and Malvo walked out with a rifle. Like, how does that happen? But he used it, and that's how he was practicing his shooting. I don't understand how he never got arrested for that, but he didn't. So leading up to all of this, there have been a lot of practice shootings. Killings, practice with quotations, obviously, because what? They were killing people for practice just so that he could get used to it and so that he could, you know, do his job essentially. So February 16th, 2002. Now, mind you, this started in October, right? In DC, the first shooting took place in February. That's months before this, my dude. Like, that's a lot. So February 16th of 2002, Kenya Nicole, she was 21, was shot and killed by Malvo at the front door of her aunt's house. They did this because her aunt was really good friends with Muhammad's ex-wife, Mildred, and she was the one who, like, pushed her to, like, get away and get a divorce. So this was definitely, like, a retaliation thing. And then on March 19th, Jerry Taylor, who was 60, was shot and killed by a single shot to the chest fired from long range. He was practicing his shot at a golf course. So there were 2 deaths and 4 more injuries that happened in other states from March to 2002. Those, I can't really find a lot of information about them, sorry. So then in August of 2002, John Gatia, 51, he was changing a tire that was slashed by Malvo in a parking lot in Louisiana. He was shot while he was changing the tire in the neck. He pretended to be dead while Malvo took his wallet, and then he ran into the service station. After he left, he went to the hospital. He was fine and he was released. On March 1st, 2010, he got a letter from Malvo apologizing. September 5th, 2002, Paul LaRuffa, 55-year-old pizzeria owner, he was shot 6 times at close range while locking up his restaurant in Clinton, Maryland. He survived the shooting. His laptop was later found in the car with them when they were arrested. So yeah, they were definitely connected to that. And then on September 21st, 41-year-old Million A. Waldermariam was fatally shot in the back of the head with a .22 caliber pistol in Atlanta, Georgia. He was helping the owner close up for the night when the shooting happened, so he truly was just like happenstance. On the same day, Claudine Parker, 52-year-old liquor store clerk that we talked about earlier, that is when her shooting happened. So her shooting happened right after Mr. Amelia was killed. So on September 23rd, 45-year-old Hong Im Ballinger was shot in the head and killed with a Bushmaster rifle in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. That was the rifle that they were using, and they were later obviously linked with those killings. February through September killing spree that was like really spread out throughout the year is what led this killing of 3 weeks, where 10 people were killed. And I believe 3 people were seriously and like critically injured. But on October 24th of 2002, John Allen Muhammad and Lee Boy Malvo were arrested. Like I said, they were found in a rest stop in Frederick County, Maryland. Once the police had seized the car, right after they were arrested, the police seized the car. They went through the car to find evidence. So they found the laptop, they found the guns, they found a whole sniper's nest in this car. Now remember when we were talking about John Muhammad, and he was a metal worker and he did all these things for the army. Yeah, that came very much in handy on being able to craft this car. He put 2 holes in the trunk of the car, one right above the license, or right like underneath the license plate or whatever, where like all you had to do was kind of like put it through and like you couldn't see it, and then another hole for the scope. So like there's one for the actual rifle itself and there's one for the scope, and like you never have to get out the car. He had extra like dark tint on his window so that you couldn't see through the back of the car. You couldn't see when he was moving, when Lee Boy Malvo would be moving throughout the car. So he was moving around, like getting in and out of his passenger seat with never getting out of the car, never opening the trunk. Like this car was set up perfectly to be a rolling sniper's nest. And it was. So yeah, they were later charged and convicted of capital murder. Malvo was arrested and convicted for capital murder, but his sentence was life imprisonment without the chance of parole. He got 6 life imprisonments without the chance of parole. Muhammad was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death. Period. That was the end of him. So there were two motives that are highly talked about when it comes to this particular case. So the initial motive, and I think the one that I believe the most, was that Muhammad had planned to do this to get back at his ex-wife, who made him feel like he was now estranged from his kids because there was a restraining order and he couldn't see them. And that the theory was, if he went on a shooting spree, no one would link him to like killing her if she were to die in the shooting spree, because it's a shooting spree. They're looking for this mass killer. No one's gonna link him, but he's gonna get custody of his kids and he's gonna get his kids back and she's gonna be dead. Sadly, this theory was not brought up in court because there was no evidence to like actually prove that was the theory. But like deep down, I really feel like that was his motive behind this, because she did leave Washington State to go hide in Maryland, and this takes place in the DMV. Like, she wasn't far from where a lot of the shootings were happening. Secondly, the other motive that comes up was the one that Malvo brings up in 2006 when he goes to court to testify against John Allen Muhammad. And he says that the goal of this was to eventually kidnap children and take them to Canada, train them to terrorize cities, and extort the government for $10 million. With the goal of shutting down America by causing more mass casualty and showing the government that they don't have control. What? How did that? I don't even understand how that just sounds outrageous. Now, I mean, that could have possibly been a conversation that they had, but that's a lot. So I'm gonna take a quick break and I will be back, because we gotta go through these trials, and these trials are a lot. Okay, y'all, so I'm gonna be right back. I'm gonna go grab me something to drink. Okay, y'all, so I'm back. Now I'm gonna try to go through this trial as quickly as possible, because this podcast is already a little long for a first episode. But here we go. In October of 2003, John Allen Muhammad's case trial starts. Their cases ended up being split, so there are two separate trials. Muhammad went on trial for the murder of Dean Myers. This happened in Prince William County in near the city of Manassas. But the trial got moved from Prince William County to Virginia Beach. Shout out 757. Because it was a high publicity case, so they wanted it to be a fair trial, so they moved it to Virginia Beach. Initially, Muhammad was granted the right to represent himself in the defense and dismiss his legal counsel. And then he immediately switched back after having a, like, being able to, like, legally represent himself in an opening argument and realizing, like, this is not going to go well, because he was being charged with murder, terrorism, conspiracy, and the illegal use of a firearm, and faced the possibility of a death sentence. He was like, yeah, I need a lawyer. So he got a lawyer, and the lawyer was trying to get the death penalty pulled off of the table, because nobody could prove if he had actually pulled the trigger. Now, on November 17th, 2003, he was convicted on all four counts against him. Capital murder for the shooting of Myers, capital murder under Virginia's anti-terrorism statute of homicide committed with the intent to terrorize the government or the public at large, conspiracy to commit murder, and the illegal use of a firearm. Now, in the penalty phase of this trial, the jury, after 5 hours of deliberation over 2 days, unanimously agreed that, like, he needs to die. They immediately sentenced him to death. So in March of 2009, a judge agreed with this and he was officially sentenced to death. He tried to appeal it many times. He was never successful. There was just too much evidence against him. And then in 2006, I'm sorry, Malvo was later brought in to try into another trial to testify against him, and he gave very detailed accounts of what the plans were. He went into details of everything that happened. There is abuse allegations and all kinds of stuff that happened, and it was just like nobody was willing to lessen his sentence, so he was given the death penalty. And in 2009, on November 10th, he was put to death by lethal injection. So that is the end of John Allen Muhammad. Now, Malvo was arrested and sent to jail in Fairfax County. He was charged in Virginia for two capital crimes, the murder of FBI analyst Lena Franklin and the commission of an act of terrorism, and the murder of more than one person in a three-year period. So due to, again, a lot of publicity around the trial in the Washington metro area, the trial was moved to Chesapeake, Virginia. Again, shout out to 757. Malvo pled not guilty for reasons of insanity to everything on the grounds that he was under Muhammad's complete control. On December 18th of 2003, after about 14 hours of deliberation, a jury convicted Malvo on both charges. On December 23rd, the jury recommended a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. And on March 10th, Malvo was officially sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now, in October, under a plea bargain to, again, avoid the death penalty, he entered an Alford plea. Now, if you don't want to know what an Alford plea is when you basically are saying, like, I'm not saying that I'm guilty, but what I am saying is that there is enough evidence out there to say that I might possibly be guilty, and so I'm gonna just go with this instead. So that's what he decided to do for the murders of Kenneth Bridges and attempting to murder Caroline Sewell. He also pled guilty to two firearms charges and agreed not to appeal his convictions for the murder of Franklin, that is the FBI agent. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole plus 8 years for the weapons charges. So this is now his second life imprisonment charge. So when John Muhammad went back on trial in 2006, Malvo went out and told authorities about the shootings that happened in 2002 and that spanned across the country. And then in October of 2006, he then pleaded guilty to the extra six charges that were put on him. This happened specifically in the state of Maryland, so he's already serving two life terms in the state of Virginia, and then he got an additional six life terms in the state of Maryland. And that was that officially happened in November of 2006. Now, in the state of Virginia, there was a ruling that happened that basically said if you're under the age of 18, life in prison is cruel and unusual punishment. So if you're under the age of 18 when you create like a heinous crime, you should be able to get out. So you can't have life without the possibility of parole. And in 2017, his life sentence was overturned. So basically, they're just saying, like, he was 17 at the time. It's unconstitutional to have him spend the rest of his life in prison. Now, the Maryland Circuit Courts did not agree with this decision at all. And they were like, look, that might be your ruling in Virginia, but that's not our ruling here in Maryland. And then in 2018, it was taken to the U.S. Court of Appeals, and they also agreed, like, no, he shouldn't be in prison for the rest of his life. So as of right now, Malvo is still in prison. He will be up for parole sometime this year in 2022. I am sure he is hoping to get out soon. He recently got married. He is currently at the Red Onion State Prison. He got married in March of 2020. I don't know why I said it like that. 2020 is when he got married. So I'm sure he's hoping he can get out and live like a relatively normal life. However, he's still fighting and appealing the life imprisonment without parole in Maryland. So even if he does get out in Virginia, he could still very likely spend the rest of his life in prison in Maryland, because that's still a thing. So he may never get out. So that's also a possibility. So yeah, this was the case of the DC sniper. Sorry if I talk too much or like ramble. I'm really trying not to. Sorry if it sounds like I'm like nervous. I am super nervous, but I'm like nervous with excitement. So hopefully you guys can hear that. But yes, I am going to try and post every Thursday. I'm going to post every Thursday. So you can listen wherever you get your podcasts. So please comment, rate, follow, all that good stuff. Subscribe, whatever it is. Do that. If you want to reach out to me or follow me, you can follow me on Instagram at True Crime Boulevard. It's TrueCrimeBLVD. I can't spell, so I'm not going to try to spell Boulevard. Okay? BLVD. That's all I got for you. I'm also reachable on email at truecrimeboulevard@gmail.com, spelled the exact same way. truecrimeblvd@gmail.com. Okay? Great. I love you guys. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for supporting me on this new journey. And yeah, if you have any suggestions of cases that you guys think I should do, if you want to give me any tips, if you just want to say hey, please feel free to. I love it. And I will talk to you guys next time. This was a trip down True Crime Boulevard with me, Bree. Thanks for joining. See you guys next week.
This was just being weird. I really don't have anything to put, so that's it.